Hi there, my name is Saul, and you are listening to The Story of London. This is a podcast that attempts to tell the history of this city in regular weekly chapters, making up one huge long narrative tale. We've reached chapter 114 of the story, and the third part of the Livery Wars, a cycle within the story that explores the political crisis that drove London to form the first livery companies, the great guilds of medieval London. This is the third part of that story of the Livery Wars, and while this episode does stand alone, it would be best appreciated if you've listened to episodes 112 and 113, which preceded it. As part of the second anniversary of the Story of London podcast, this is the second episode being dropped this week, as this mammoth and exciting few years are played out upon the streets of London. But just in case you haven't listened to what's gone before, so, after Mayor Sir John Le Blund had finished his six-year term, the goldsmith Nicholas de Farnham had taken office. He was firmly linked to the forces who supported the king and his favourite, his best friend and person he was clearly infatuated with, Piers Gaveston. In response to this, London picked the hardline sheriff and veteran London politician Thomas Remain to become mayor. Many wanted him to stand up for London, but Remain saw the city tearing itself apart. And while the king's power seemed to be on the decline, he tried to balance London between the two factions, the king on one side and the noble lords of England on the other, representing themselves in a group calling itself the Lords Ordainers, who were pushing to reform the kingdom. London, desperate for someone radical to lead them, threw the support behind a mercer called Richard de Reefham. But he clearly would not allow London to defy the king and had been toppled from the position of mayor due to internal politics. And so in the summer of 1311, London was still looking for a mayor who would stick their neck out for the city and get behind the Lords Ordainers. And they found him. And this is the story we tell this episode. Welcome then to chapter 114 of The Story of London, a sudden eruption of unexpected violence. London needed to pick a new mayor, and into this situation came a man called John de Guisors. If regular listeners feel they've heard that name before, they would be correct. This is the third John de Guisors in relatively recent London history. The Guisors family had been merchants in the Vintry Ward since the first of them came from Normandy at the end of the 12th century. They had served the crown as King's Chamberlains of London, and had held civic office almost continuously throughout the 13th century. John de Guisors came from a well-known London family. This particular John de Guisors was involved in the wine trade, and it was believed that as a vintner he'd be an ideal candidate to stand strong against foreign influence, and by extension, the king's influence. Of all London's mercantile interests, the vintners had suffered the most from the opening of the royal markets to foreigners, and under Edward II, the Gascon wine merchants almost monopolised the trade. Guisors could give far more wholehearted support than Mayors Remain or Reefham to the demands of the retailers for protection. As such, he sought to gain validation for his actions by tapping the large well of popular feeling regarding protecting the rights of London's citizens and its franchise. De Guisors could cast himself as a populist mayor, the like of which we'd not seen in London since Mayor Harvey. And this explains why Mayor de Guisors sought to act through assemblies of the commonality, composed of representatives from each of the London wards whom he could rely on for support. In November 1311, along with eight other aldermen, he presided over one such assembly which elected their own nominees as the officers of the city. The crown had no say in this one. The aldermen pepperers, so the likes of Remain, Layer and Savant, were conspicuously absent from this meeting, as they were to be from many of the other assemblies of the commonality through which Guisors chose to work. The parties were forming, battle lines were being drawn, London was shaping up for a hell of a political fight. At the beginning of 1312, the national crisis worsened when Piers Gaveston returned from exile. The king sent letters to the mayor, 8 aldermen, and members of the commonalty of the city, asking them to keep the city loyal to him. He also sent individual copies to 20 prominent Londoners. Of these, 3 of the aldermen and 6 of the commoners were pepperers by profession. The king at least had a clear idea of who was likely to support him in the city. The pepperers' close ties with the Italians separated them from the great majority of their fellow citizens, who identified with the renewed campaign of the Ordainers with their own struggle to preserve the privileges of the city. Throughout the spring of 1312, the agitation in the city intensified, as it seemed that the barons and the Lords Ordainers were preparing for war. The commonality pressed Mayor John de Guisos for additional measures to keep the city safe for the Lords Ordainers. They wanted to ensure that the royalists amongst the aldermen did not communicate with the king in the city's name without their knowledge. In Holy Week, the commonality demanded that no letters committing the city to any course of action would be sent in their name unless they were all assembled and gave their unanimous consent. The Common Seal of London was to be kept in the safekeeping of 3 of the commonality as well as 3 of the aldermen, so it could not be used without their knowledge. This was no simple conflict, though, of the commonality against the aldermen. The commonality's demand revealed the interests they were fighting for. No strangers were to be admitted to the freedom of the city except with the assent of the commonality in full assembly or in full hustings. No more foreigners were to be admitted as citizens because the king or the great lords requested it, and the privileges of citizenship of London were to be conferred only to those who already acquired them. To encourage the mayor to support their demands, the commonality granted him £40 for his official expenses, almost the whole of the sum in the city treasury. But John de Guisos, while supportive of this, would not consent to agree to this without others in the city's ruling class to back him up. Guisos was not going to go into a row with the king as wildly as Mayor Walter Harvey or Thomas FitzThomas. No, he wanted to at least try to bring over as many of the city's aldermen with him as possible. Thus, it was 3 weeks before Guisos, in company with 14 other aldermen, gave his assent to the commonality's demands. Almost certainly, it took him all this time to win over the majority of aldermen to support this policy. Only one of the pepperers, the former sheriff and mayor, Thomas Remain, added his name to this list. Pepperer, aldermen Leia and Savant did not, and Remain probably just did it to preserve the city's unity, and therefore he joined this majority. None of the pepperers, though, were present when a few days later, John de Guisos pushed the anti-foreigner policy to its logical conclusion. He and 5 other aldermen summoned all the foreign merchants before them and warned them not to stay for more than 40 days in the city on pain of losing their goods. The Carta Mercatoria was dead. The old rules of London were now back in effect. Although the leading pepperers disassociated themselves from this policy, there were others in the pepper and spice trade who advocated it. The spices and apocryphies of Cheapside had suffered more than the wholesale pepperers from the effects of the Carta Mercatoria, and they had, therefore, most to fear if the foreigners gained the freedom and began to compete in the lucrative supply of drugs and medicines to the rich and the great. You begin to see divisions between the pepperers and the spicers. The apocrypharies in London now had a strident political cause, and they were militant. It is therefore not surprising that a June 1312, a full assembly, composed of 12 men from each ward of London, chose, as one of the city's members of parliament to be held in Lincoln, the Cheapside apocryphy, John de Selling. The parliament in question was actually postponed, and John de Selling never sat as a member of Parliament, but his choice at the time was really significant. Selling came of knightly family in Kent and was one of the wealthiest dealers in the spice trade living on Cheapside. In fact, the only dealer in spices on that street who was richer than him was an Italian called Bartholomew Thomason, originally from Lucca in Italy. 9 years earlier, In 1303, it seems that de Selling had already been working for the Queen as an apothecary, and clearly his ambitions lay in the direction of the court. He was a rich man. How rich was he? Well, by 1310, he was sufficiently established in his trade to borrow the grand sum of £438 from a man in Abingdon, probably to purchase wool. And he then later lent 50 marks of silver to a citizen of Beverley, the centre of the cloth trade. He was also buying about £100 worth of goods and credits from the Frescobaldis. So he was a very rich London shop owner who reinvested his profits to invest in the lucrative wool trade. On the surface, there is little to distinguish his economic interests from those of the alderman pepperers like Romaine. And yet he determinedly separated himself from them, as did most of the spices of Cheapside. Selling obviously saw himself as an apothecary first, and in the eyes of the apothecary, foreigners such as Bartholomew Tomansin were rivals for the patronage of the great and the good. Selling should not be seen as a man of the people. He could suck up to nobles as quick as anyone. He had prospered through the patronage of Gilbert de Clare, the Earl of Gloucester. But de Clare was one of the most prominent Lord's Ordainers and was acting as guardian of the realm in 1311 when he had arrested the Frescobaldi and impounded their goods. Selling was Gloucester's man and he was rewarded for this. And this actually worked out at the time to his benefit. Back in 1310, Gloucester obtained for Selling exemptions from all taxes and assessments levied on the City of London and from all personal liability in his civic duties. Privileges like this, obtained by the favour of a great lord, would normally have antagonised his fellow citizens and would have isolated Selling. But in 1312, his connection with the Lord's Ordainers and the main Lord Ordainer was evidently seen as an asset by the commonalty, and Selling himself as a man who could be relied upon to promote the anti-foreigner cause. Joining this cause were the rope makers, the ropers. And that's interesting. A new generation of ropers, unlike their predecessors who I described back in chapter 108, only 15 or 20 years earlier, now emerged on the scene. And these ropers seem to have been men of modest means. Richard de Dorset and John de Burringham, who were two ropers at the time, had credit transactions of only a few marks or shillings. Some of them still dealt in wool, but on a small scale. And probably their fortunes had suffered because the Carta Mercatoria meant that the Germans in the steelyard no longer needed to use them as middlemen and had cut them out of the import and export of wool business, trading directly from the East Coast, crippling the mercantile ropers who had emerged less than a generation earlier. The ropers were very much now in the anti-foreigner political faction. And all of this explains why the Spicer from Cheapside was made MP. It wasn't that Selling went to Parliament that mattered. It was the choice of him that showed the political temperament in London at this time. And yet, while this was going on, something happened nationally that totally dictated the changing political fortunes of London. The ordinances given out by the Lords Ordainers included one which the King could not keep evading, and which had become the principal issue at the heart of England's political discourses, the exile of Piers Gaveston. It was made clear to Edward that the outcome of his refusal to submit would be a civil war. The ordinances were publicly proclaimed at Paul's Cross in London on the 27th of September 1311. Gaveston was to be out of the country, stripped of his titles, and condemned to perpetual exile by the 1st of November. In the interim, he remained with the king, but in the end, it was on the 3rd of November, he left. But he did not go far, and he did not go for long. As we said earlier on in the chapter, by the end of this month, he was rumoured to be back in England, with the rumours saying he was in Westminster, others had gone to Cornwall, others that he was hiding elsewhere. Possibly he persuaded the king that the best way of evading the ordinances was simply to ignore them, for with the approach of the Christmas season, all pretense at secrecy was abandoned. The king held his Christmas court at Windsor Castle, and Piers Gaveston appeared openly at his side. Gaveston's refusal to obey the Lord's Ordainers resulted in a highly supportive of the Ordainers Archbishop of Canterbury hitting Piers Gaveston with an immediate excommunication, and yet the king ignored this and went on to bestow upon his favourite the Earldom of Cornwall for the third time. And the Lords of England properly prepared for civil war. At this point, even the king's nephew, the Earl of Gloucester, was prepared to fight against him, and with the other earls, he took an oath to defend the ordinances. Of course, no one was saying at the time, "We're gathering troops to go to war with the King of England." No, that would be treason. But the earls all started to organise lots of local tournaments, which would provide reasons for armed gatherings, while keeping secret their real intentions until the last moment. But King Edward II saw through this, and he knew what was going on. So he came up with a bold plan. Early in 1312, he and Piers Gaveston made for the north, intending to negotiate with Robert the Bruce for Gaveston's safety to be guaranteed in Scotland. Robert the Bruce was having none of it, and the king and Piers were left stranded in Newcastle, and then were threatened by the approach of Thomas of Lancaster, the Earl of Lancaster. Edward and Gaveston were very unwilling to be besieged in Newcastle, mostly because the people were unwilling to defend him. So they fled to Tynmouth, and thence, even more embarrassingly, they had to take a boat to Scarborough. And so fast was the king and his favourite's madcap attempt to stay ahead of the Earl of Lancaster, that then when they fled Tynmouth, they did so with so much haste that they left behind, oh, I don't know, their household baggages, their furniture, their arms, their treasures. Oh, and the king left behind his unfortunate queen, who had just suffered the humiliation of being dragged around the country in the wake of a husband and his boyfriend, and then suddenly by being abandoned. No doubt her situation was made worse by the fact that the king had not neglected his dynastic duty. She was 3 months pregnant when he jumped on a boat to Scarborough and left her behind. Isabella was captured, although we could really say she was rescued, by Thomas of Lancaster, who comforted her with the promise that he would not rest until he had separated the king and Gaveston. By the time that Lancaster began his chase again, Edward and Gaveston had separated by mutual consent, however. Gaveston had taken refuge in the castle of Scarborough, perched seemingly on impregnable cliffs, while the king had gone to York, presumably with the intention of gathering reinforcements to resist the earls. Since it had not been necessary for the Earl of Lancaster to separate Edward and Gaveston forcibly, he took it upon himself to at least ensure they would not rejoin each other. While Lancaster led his forces and stationed himself midway between Scarborough and York, the Earls of Pembroke and Surrey, aided by Henry Percy, laid siege to Scarborough Castle. Scarborough was very badly provisioned. It couldn't survive any kind of extended siege. At the end of a fortnight, Piers Gaveston was obliged to come to terms with his besiegers. He agreed to surrender, provided the men capturing him would swear upon his safety that he would be presented before Parliament and they should decide his future. Oddly enough, the men besieging him agreed, and they also agreed that his retainers would be permitted to remain in control of Scarborough Castle until August, and they were free to resupply it during that time. And if, by that August, Parliament had not decided the future of Piers Gaveston, he'd be permitted to return to Scarborough. These exceptionally generous terms were given to Gaveston from the Earl of Pembroke, who was displaying knightly virtue and mercy, and on the 19th of May 1312, Gaveston surrendered to Pembroke, Surrey and Percy, who on their side all swore upon the Eucharist that they would abide faithfully by the surrender terms. Pembroke took it upon himself to escort Gaveston to his own castle of Wallingford, where he could remain in custody until the opening of Parliament. A leisurely southward journey had brought them to the village of Deddington, 10 miles south of Banbury, round about the evening of the 9th of June. Here the Earl of Pembroke, naturally wishing to spend a night with his wife, who was only a few miles away at his manor in Bampton, left his prisoner, without even the slightest suspicion that the other earls might take the law into their own hands. This was a big mistake, for the Earl of Warwick was more than happy to do so. Early in the morning of the 10th of June, he brought an armed force to surround Deddington Rectory, where Gaveston was lodging, and he entered the house to kick awake the young man with the words, "Get up, traitor, you are taken." Gaveston was not permitted to prepare himself for his fate with any dignity, but he was hustled barefoot out of the house and forced to walk with his captors towards the town of Warwick. Eventually, after they'd brought him some miles, they relented of their rough treatment and put Loudon to mount a mare for the rest of the journey. Not because they felt sorry for him, more they needed him to hurry the hell up. At Warwick, a crowd inevitably materialised to jeer him and to see him led to the castle, where he was unceremoniously thrown into the dungeon. The Earl of Warwick, on his return to Dedington, was furious, not because he had any feelings towards Gaveston, but because he'd taken an oath to protect him and had pledged upon his honour, but he could do nothing. The Earl of Warwick was joined at Warwick Castle by the Earls of Lancaster, Hereford and Arundel. The four earls all agreed that Gaveston must pay the penalty for his misdeeds, yet Warwick stood aside while Lancaster assumed responsibility for extracting this penalty. The earls decided that, even though Gaveston must die, since he was the Earl of Cornwall, whether they approved of the fact or not, and since he was Gloucester's brother-in-law and the husband of the king's niece, they agreed he should die as a nobleman, by beheading. Accordingly, on the 19th of June, they brought him out of his dungeon and marched him to Blucklow Hill, 2 miles from Warwick, and within the estates of Thomas of Lancaster. There, while Warwick lurked in his castle and Lancaster, Hereford and Arundel watched from a distance, Gaveston was beheaded. His head was presented to the Earl of Lancaster, and thus he was irrevocably marked as the man responsible for this deed. The earls returned whence they came, leaving the headless corpse where it lay. Subsequently, after this, it becomes a rather macabre and grim story. Four cobblers took up the body and carried it on the ladder to the Earl of Warwick, but he refused to receive it. Therefore, with a strange determination, they sewed the head back on the body and carried it to the Dominicans over in Oxford, who did receive it, and they embalmed the body. But they kept it unburied, since Gaveston had died under the Archbishop of Canterbury's excommunication. Yeesh. Regardless of this, Piers Gaveston, the favourite peacock of the king, was dead. In truth, it's difficult to see if his actions had actually merited his death. Essentially, Piers paid the penalty for the king's misdeeds, rather than his own. Look, it's obvious he was clearly somewhat annoying as a person. No doubt he could be condemned as the instigator of the king's follies. I mean, certainly that was the view taken by the Lords Ordainers when they castigated him as having, quote, misled and ill-advised our lord the king and enticed him to do evil in various deceitful ways, unquote. But Gaveston was legitimately noble-born, and he might have actually held high office in the state without comment if his rise had been sufficiently gradual. He was made to appear an upstart by the instantaneousness of his advancement and by the openness of the king's favour. The complaints from the king that he was a foreigner were, of course, nonsense. I mean, he was from Gascony, which meant he was a born English subject. And being from Gascony was probably not noticeably more foreign than most of the Norman French-speaking nobility of England. These professed reasons for hating him have the appearance of excuses rather than realities. Undoubtedly, envy at his good fortune, hatred aroused by his arrogance, and disgust at the king's unconcealed infatuation with him were the causes of the brutal scene on Blacklow Hill. Still, he was dead now, and this changed everything. That June, the winter, John de Guise's, with the support of the Mercers and the more radical factions, had taken the lead in London politics during those tense and fevered days of the chase down of Piers Gaveston. But then come July, Gaveston was murdered. In revulsion at his death, the moderates Earl of Pembroke and Warenne deserted their fellow ordainers to join the king. Edward soon felt strong enough to return to London. On the 26th of June, and again on the 11th of July, he ordered the mayor to hold the city for him. The radical Mercer troublemaker I mentioned last chapter, William de Hackford, and his fellow radical Mercers were determined that the city should not revert to royal control. On the 24th of July, the king wrote to the sheriff from Westminster, forbidding, quote, the holding of conventicles and the making of federations and bonds to live and die together, whereby the people may be terrified and the king's peace disturbed. The king was aware there were groups organising against him in support of the Lord's Ordainers in London, but the strength of the Lord's Ordainers had just been broken over the murder of Piers Gaveston. The king was reading the mood right. The richer elements of London realised that sticking your neck out too far to support the Ordainers could be very bad for the city's health. Things seemed to be turning against them. If the likes of Hackford were pushing the city to stand up against the king, maybe it would be a good idea to stop that. William Hackford and his associates were imprisoned by the constable of the Tower and accused of plotting to open the gates of the city to the Ordainers. The city's population, the common population, rallied to the support of these men. And it meant that while the king and the barons were beginning to move towards a compromise, the city remained defiant in its opposition to the crown. And we saw this manifested in popular elections. John de Guises was re-elected mayor, and a mercer and a fishmonger were elected sheriffs. The mayor's support for and dependence upon the organised crafts was illustrated by the nature of the assembly he presided over in December 1312. It was elected not by the wards, but by the crafts, the mysteries. No pepperers were amongst the aldermen who took part. Confident of their strength and prominence in the council of the city, that December, the mercers, the fishmongers, the vinters and the drapers all appeared in their liveries to celebrate the birth of a son to the Queen. The Commons of London not only had a cause, they not only had professions to organise around, they now had uniforms. The uniforms of defiance, the liveries of London. But that gathering of the fishmongers and their supporters and vinters and drapers and mercers were not joined by the pepperers. They and their people preferred to distance themselves from the allies of the Lord's Ordainers. See, they understood that the murder of Gaveston had changed the political debate in England. The cause of the Ordainers was waning. The mayor and the aldermen began the new year in 1313 by showing their defiance and resisting the king's declared intention of raising direct taxes from London. But as Ordainer support crumbled, they found it expedient within a week to agree, you know, maybe they could loan the king 1,000 marks. From that point, the influence of the pepperers began to increase, as quietly as became clear that the king, now his boyfriend was gone, was regaining power. The smart money in London saw which way the wind was blowing. The city pivoted fast. In July 1313, the pepperers William de Layer and William Savant were chosen as two of the city's representatives in Parliament. Simon Corp, another pepperer, became the alderman of Cordwainer, and in September 1313, the mayor, John de Guises, and the alderman and the commonalty agreed that only the better men of each ward should be summoned to elect the sheriffs, quote, for the avoiding of certain perils which may arise, unquote. The common elements of the commonality were being quietly removed from London's political debates. In October that year, the Ordainers had to accept a settlement which represented a victory for the king. For the time being, the pepperers and other conservative forces in London were in ascendant. The pendulum had swung the other way. Understand, the more conservative elements of London, the pepperers, were not huge fans of the king's. They were just preventing the city from throwing their weight too far behind the national political faction that was the Ordainers. And it did seem like the king's cause was on the rise. And then, the following June, came the Battle of Bannockburn. The massive defeat of the English army of Edward II was in effect the victory of the Scots and them regaining their independence. The king's army was destroyed in one of the greatest disasters ever to befall an English force. bereft of military power, the crown was helpless in the face of the resurgent Ordainers. Once more, the balance of power for political forces in London was determined by outside events. The York Parliament of 1314 led to a wholesale purge of the royal administration under the Ordainers' direction and the replacement of the sheriffs of England by men sympathetic to their cause. And yet, London did not erupt into communal violence over this. And, well, they found a path through this. London did not suddenly veer towards supporting the radicals like William Hackford, but neither did they stand alone to defend the king. A compromise was found within the city's internal factions, and into the tense politics after the York Parliament stepped the alderman, former sheriff, and the man who held on to William Wallace for an evening, the hardcore conservative fixer and pepperer, William de Leyer. De Leyer, who had been acting mayor under the conservative Henry de Welis, seems to have struck a deal and formed an alliance with the supposedly radical mayor, John de Guisors. And the pair of them somehow led London's interests together at this juncture. The federations, the oaths, the illegal gatherings of Hackford's politics could only have frightened men of substance in all the mercantile industries and in the crafts. Hackford's politics raised the spectre of lawlessness and the subversion of the accepted principle that, you know, said in London, London should be run by men of wealth and standing. Aldermen such as Mayor Guisors, who had supported the anti-foreigner movement until they won protection for their trade, now felt safer making an alliance with de Leyer. His wealth and long career in politics as sheriff back in 1290 and since 1298 as the formidable leader of the Conservative and Royalist Party amongst the aldermen contributed heavily to his authority and prestige. He was a figure men naturally turned to in the face of national defeat and the very real threat of civil war. The aldermen's choice of supporting an alliance between Leyers and Guisors and the commonalty's choice of choosing Reform and the lawyer Kelsey as the city's members of parliament in August 1314 indicate a drawing together of the city's elite in the face of dangerous instability in the country. This alliance was confirmed when Leyer was re-elected to parliament by the city in January 1315. The new alliance was successful in forcing the Ordainers to reconcile with the conservative forces in the city. They dropped their plan to conduct an inquiry into all who held the office in the city since the beginning of the king's reign and made another concession which obliged the steward and the marshal of the royal household to respect the city's charter. If Mayor de Guisors was scratching Alderman de Leyer's back, he also returned the favour. De Leyer supported Guisors and the Vinters in refusing the city's assent to a writ which ordered them to restore the wine which the city had seized from the Gascon wine merchants. The Gascons, they said, had sold wine to a merchant strangers for resale, quote, contrary to the franchise and custom of the city, unquote. It had been confiscated all fair and square, like, and the two sides agreed we're going to be keeping it. And that hints at the other reason why the various merchants and mercantile elements of London suddenly pulled together like this. The Lords Ordainers had suspended the Carta Mercatorium. This had given the London merchants, especially the ones who get their hands on credit due to the money they made, one hell of an opportunity. The suspension of the Carta Mercatoria in 1311 had an immediate effect on foreign imports, which now began to decline. The opportunity was therefore given to the English wool exporters to take over the foreigners' trade. Now, they were actually encouraged to do this because of concessions made by the city of Bruges in 1309, which permitted foreigners there to trade freely amongst themselves. This meant that the foreigners could import spices and dyes from Bruges, take them to the fairs of England, and cut out the Londoners. Basically, for the first time, many of the pepperers began to find common cause with the mercers and the vinters. It was time for the trades of London to organise. And another incentive for them to do it was the introduction in 1313 of the first wool staple, or compulsory market, where all the English wool had to be sold. By 1313, it had become unsafe for English merchants to trade in Flanders, and their shipping needed protection. The choice they had was either to surrender the wool trade entirely to foreign merchants, or for a port near Flanders to be designated as a compulsory staple, which would permit some kind of convoy system to be set up. Since the English were exporting 65% of the country's wool, and the Crown was eager for support of the mercantile community, it could not resist the pressure for a staple being established overseas. The French town of Saint-Omer was chosen as the nearest neutral port to Flanders. The choice of Saint-Omer meant that from 1313, more and more wool was funneled through the port of London for export to the staple. Wool from the Midlands and from Herefordshire, which might have previously been carted to Boston for export, was now taken to London for the shorter sea crossing. Wool merchants from Ledbury, Whitney and Ludlow appear as business partners of London's merchants. The Port of London accordingly increased its share of the kingdom's wool exports, and about one half of the total was now being exported out of the city. And because of the protections the citizens had gained from the Lords Ordainers, that meant they, rather than the foreigners, were carrying it. By 1315 then, London was on a roll. The merchants and aldermen had been so split over so many political issues, were now seemingly united. All of them, mercers, vinters, pepperers and more, could see that with so much wool now coming through the city to go to Saint-Omer, fortunes could be made. Any uncertainty about supporting the traditional rights of the city were now put to one side. The supposed ultra-conservative factions under Alderman de Leia and the supposed radical faction under Mayor John de Guizos united to exploit this unique opportunity. And the true radicals, the likes of Hackford, the men who advocated the people should run the city, as represented via their trade clerks, who would dress in liveries to denote which political gang they belonged to, they were pushed to the side. They were not without influence or power. They remained brightly coloured, uniformed threat to the new status quo. But London now had a working, political, compromised faction in charge of the city. And it was good, because the last few years had shown to everyone in the city that nothing was permanent. Political fortunes could change in a moment. And in fact, over recent years, London had seen how fast change could hit even seemingly unchangeable things. In 1308, the king had finally, after being admonished by the Pope, moved against the Knights Templars. And on January 8th that year, members of the order were arrested and its dissolution began. Imprisonment and torture began in earnest, and the jails of London were filled up with knights. The Templars' watermill on the bank of the River Fleet and other structures were demolished to give access to boats up that river once more, and the legal complaints which had begun about the Templars and the River Fleet, which had begun 149 years earlier, were finally ended. The Inquisition of the Templars continued through 1309, held either in Holy Trinity Priory over by Aldgate or All Hallows Barking near the Tower of London. But we will come back to that Inquisition. I intend to do a lot more on the fall of the Templars, but as you can tell, London's political situation was made more important to the story. Most of their properties and assets were given to their fellow knightly order, the Knights Hospital up in Clerkenwell. And there is a persistent historical anecdote that those Knights Templar not arrested and jailed escaped to where they were not being condemned, Scotland. It is said that Knights Templar fought on the sides of the Scots at the Battle of Bannockburn. With all the political tensions and the rise and falls of King's favourites and the sudden rise and seeming fall and then rise again of the Lords Ordainers, you'd be mistaken for thinking that London was too busy for, you know, running the city during this era. But that was far from the truth. In 1309, one of the succession of orders from the city's authorities to keep the streets clean was reissued this year. It complained of a odour in the streets and lanes in order that it should always be disposed of in the Thames or outside the city. In 1310, a rather desperate-sounding order was issued, wherein the city acknowledged that, although on numerous occasions the tailors had been forbidden to scour furs during the daytime, the law was being flagrantly disobeyed, especially in Cheapside. As a compromise, the new order stated that any tailor doing that business during the day, could they please do it in some, quote, dead lane, such as behind St. Martin's Le Grand or over near the London Wall, where no great lords are passing, either coming or going, unquote. And we also know by 1315, while outside of London's purview, the inhabitants of Westminster were complaining about the footway from Temple Bar to the King's Palace at Westminster, and saying it was so bad that the feet of horses and of rich and poor men received constant damage, and that it was interrupted by thickets and bushes. The city still had needs, obviously, and the city was still seeing building going on. In 1309, St. Anthony's Hospital was rebuilt this year. The building was so splendid that it drew people and revenue from the nearby St. Benet Fink Church. And then in 1314, the cross and ball of the belfry of St. Paul's was taken down because they were considered dangerous. And at that, quote, a new cross with a ball well gilded was set up, and many relics of saints for the protection of the belfry and the whole edifice attached to it, with a great and solemn procession replaced in the cross by the bishop, unquote. A new top of St. Paul's was placed on, and it was a hell of a structure. I mean, the belfry tower measured 260 feet from the ground, and the wooden spire was 274 feet. The ball of the steeple could contain 10 bushels of wheat, and the length of the cross on top of the ball was 15 feet, when its width was 6 feet. This was a mammoth structure, towering over London. But even with all of this, the tensions in the city were always close to the surface. In 1312, the fear of the barons launching an attack upon London was so great that it was ordered that the city should be put on intensive guard and that no armed strangers should be allowed in. The gates and the walls were to be put on full repair, and each gate was to have 6 men posted on it, and between 100 and 200 men were patrolling the city each night during this era. And those repairs of the walls that needed to be done, these were a thing. In 1315, the rebuilding of the city wall around the precincts of Blackfriars was still incomplete, and the king granted the city customs revenues to finance the building work and finishing it. A new turret was built at the furthest corner, overlooking the Thames. But this emergency rebuilding of the wall also then caused a sudden issue with the Tower of London. The tower had been sat dominating London quietly during this era. I mean, nothing much had happened. I mean, as far as we can tell, in 1314, the king ordered that his lion, remember him, he's housed at the Tower of London, he should be fed a quarter of mutton each day, and that his keeper should be paid 3.5p. The business was just carrying on. But it was at the tower that there was an unexpected moment of unforeseen violence. Just as the city's political tension seemed to be easing, just as things seemed to be calming down. Well, further strengthening of the Tower of London had been proceeding along, and the king had built a new wall to the southwest of the Lion Gate. And this wall encroached upon territory that was supposedly part of the City of London. Now, the aldermen and the leaders of the city, safely ensconced in the new alliance of Mayor Guisors and Alderman de Layer, they were not about to rock the boat over this. But somebody was upset. And how do we know? Because the records say that on a summer's night in 1315, quote, an earthen wall was thrown down by malefactors of the City of London, with a body of armed men on horseback and on foot, unquote. So, these aren't just Londoners tearing down a wall because it encroached on their territory. These are armed Londoners. And their leaders are on horseback. And they're there in numbers. And they are openly tearing down a wall erected by the king. And given no one's name is responsible, it probably means there was large numbers coming together to do the act and also to provide coverage. Who was doing this? I believe it's the livery gangs of London being active. It's the livery gangs showing they were prepared to use violence to make a point. But at least at this point, it's violence against property. It's just a wall attached to the Tower of London. By itself, it's an event that warrants at most a small footnote in any historical record. The thing is, it was not a footnote. It was a warning. The liveries of London were prepared to take the law into their own hands. It started with the wall, but it would not remain at that for long. London would soon see people be the object of violence of the livery companies, and the political crisis which had just gripped the city, that was far from over. Thanks for listening. Hope you could follow along. Incredibly complex sequence of events, and trying to put it into some kind of semblance and order has been really difficult. Also, doing two episodes in a week has been really difficult. I'll be back next week with just the one episode as we carry on with the livery wars. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed it. Story of London carries on. I've still got a long way to go. Cheers. Bye.